because people saw him as authentic. He took responsibility. He was transparent, admitted his mistakes, and gave people a sense of action beforehand.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And, perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. This interview is from the archives of my radio show, Business in Motion, which I hosted for 19 years. In this interview with Terry Flynn, we discussed communication during a crisis, in particular, how to prepare and how to respond. Terry Flynn talks about three corporate crises: the Tylenol poisoning of 1982, the Walkerton E. coli outbreak of 2000, and the maple leaf listeriosis outbreak of 2008. Also notice that he used the term new normal in this interview, which was conducted in December 2013. Crisis management, that's not a crisis communications. Those aren't words that we tend to hear a lot of. Is that important to business people? Or is it, well, you know, that's never going to happen to us, so we don't need to know that?
I think it's just good business. I think any business organization, whether it's a for-profit or a not-for-profit, has to always think about the bumps in the road, the challenges that they would face from a competitive environment, about what they need to do to make sure that they are anticipating change and anticipating the kind of challenges that they would face that could stop them from achieving their mission successfully. So I think some organizations call it business continuity. Others call it succession planning. Others call it insurance. You know, what are you doing on a day-to-day basis to make sure that you're going to be in business tomorrow? And you know, crises befall us every day. If you look at a newspaper, if you look at the TV, you know, it could be a small business that has a personal tragedy. It could be a large organization that has an oil spill, a train wreck, a plane crash. It doesn't matter. It happens every day because the human environment is dynamic. And things change. We don't have constant. So people cause crises. Systems cause crises. Government cause crises. So that's why it's important to think about it. And this is the kind of thing that it should just only be reserved for large scale organizations like a university or a chemical company. A one person organization, if you don't have that income coming in, you're going to be in a crisis. I remember when I started my own business in 1993, my insurance broker said to me, "Well, we got to talk about disability insurance." And I said, "Well, I'm not planning on being disabled here." He said, "But if you are, who's going to take care of the two kids that you have and your wife from a financial standpoint?" So that's the kind of conditioning that you have to think about as a business owner. To what degree do you have to put systems in place to help you succeed in the event of something unexpected going on?
So the whole crisis management and communication management, it's more than just how to put a spin on bad things.
Yeah, I don't like the word spin. I don't like somebody once called me a spin doctor, and I really I took offense to it, because what spin is, you know, and it has a negative connotation because it comes from the world of politics, right? Mm-hmm. A politician could say, you know, "We're here to announce the reopening and launching of something," and you go, "Yeah, no, you're not."
Right? Yeah, and we know it's a pack of lies, right, when they're talking to us.
So spin, by its nature, is a purposeful shading of the truth, right? Doesn't mean that they're lying or being deceitful, but they're giving their own perspective or frame. You know, communications is organizations are in the business of communications. If we don't communicate, we're not going to, in fact, achieve our goals and mission. But the challenge is that because we are humans and we engage in communication every day, we think just because we talk, we in fact communicate. And that's so far from the truth. What we want to be able to do is to, in fact, engage in positive, supportive behavior. So you reach out to me, you send me an email, "Can you come on my show?" You've got a mission to achieve. You've got to make sure that this show runs every week. So now you've got to get people to do it. So you're engaged and you're reaching out to me with some kind of persuasive communication that's going to engage supportive behavior on my part. Get me into the studio. So, George, you did a good job. Here I am on a Friday after classes are done. So perfect timing. And now my job is to show you, you said that I'm an expert. I have to, in fact, convince you and your audience that, in fact, I have that expertise. So we're doing this on a day-to-day basis. Most of the time we do it authentically, transparently, and with a sense of a truth and purpose. So communications and the art and science of communications is really about how organizations can help achieve their goals and missions through communicative behavior, right? So acts of communications. When I want my employees to increase productivity by 15%, I can say to them, do it or you're out of a job, or I can find ways of motivating them, changing their behavior through communication. And that might not just be words, it may be my actions. You know, hey, we've got this big job to do, so I'm buying dinner tonight, or I'm bringing the donuts, or we're going to go on a retreat. We're going to enjoy the pleasures of doing that. And that's communications, right? That's showing that I'm interested in developing a relationship with my employees or my stakeholders so that we can achieve our goals together.
When your students walk into your first class at the beginning of term, is there some – or what is the first myth that you dispel for them?
Well, it's interesting. So this past term, I got to teach our big introduction to communication class. So first-year students, first term in school. So the big myth is that they have that they're going to get 90% in a class. That's the big myth, that we have to make sure that they understand that university is a little bit different than high school. I think the biggest myth is that we are not good communicators. Everybody thinks that we're excellent communicators.
Right? By nature, right? We're not good communicators.
We're not. We're not, because if we were really good communicators, we wouldn't be, I didn't understand, Dr. Flynn, that assignment was due this week. I thought it was – so I take responsibility, even though on my syllabus I say we're in week number 7. It's – right? We don't listen well. We don't provide good feedback, or we take too much noise in that dissuades us or in fact confuses us from what the real task is. And the other thing that I try to dissuade my first-year students into thinking is that they are in fact – that we are in fact as humans good multitaskers. We're terrible multitaskers. We're multi-shifters. We can shift from topic or screen or idea or people, but in terms of learning, we don't learn on a multitask methodology, right? We can't be doing all these things and learn at the same time. Learning is pretty linear, and science has continued to show us, in fact, that we are our learning has been detrimentally impacted by multi-shifting than beforehand. So I think that's some of it. And I think what we also want to tell them in that big first class is that we have to be more purposeful in our communications skills in order to achieve what we did. So less than a half an hour ago, I had a first-year student come in who missed an assignment.
Pleaded for forgiveness.
Pleading for some kind of exemption.
I've been there.
And I said, okay, give it your best shot. Convince me. Oh, I wasn't ready for that. Oh, you wanted me to – I said, well, you've sent me an email and asking me to come and meet with you, so convince me. Show me your best level of argumentation on why I should believe you, why I should do this for you. And not ready. So I gave him a 5 o'clock assignment. So he has to have an assignment due to me by 5 o'clock to convince me. So I think we just take communications for granted, because – when we open our mouth, generally speaking, something generally comes out. And sometimes there's a connection to doing our cognitive processing and our verbalization of that. But most organizations don't do it well. And I think that's why the study in the art and science of communications is critically important for us to understand why we make those good decisions. You know, a lot of the research I'm doing now is looking at – you've heard of terms like behavioral finance, behavioral economics, behavioral communications. Why do people buy that? Why do people follow that person? Why do they believe that person is trusted and credible? And we want to understand why that is. You know, one of the biggest studies I did was on the Maple Leaf Foods crisis afterwards, and looked at Michael McCain, CEO of Maple Leaf Foods, because I was overwhelmingly astonished that this CEO, after killing 23 people, had some of the highest level of credibility in Canadian history.
Why was he able to do that?
Because people saw him as authentic. He took responsibility. He was transparent, admitted his mistakes, and gave people a sense of action beforehand. For the company, they had a pretty significant market share amongst Canadians, so that's good news. There's some kind of economic relationship, but he turned that economic relationship into a societal relationship. He made people part of this journey, and he was authentically moved when people saw him on those videos, so that they in fact believed him, and that his trust and credibility actually increased by 10% over that time of their crisis. And what astonished me more than that is that in August of 2008, when they entered that crisis, their stock was $10.90 a unit. The fall of 2008, economic collapse, 40% decrease in the market. In January of 2009, his stock was $11.
So it went up after the crisis.
He increased market share and market value during a crisis that killed 22 people.
Now, I've heard that if you stumble and you recover well, people actually think better of you than if everything had just gone well all the time. Have you seen that happen?
Well, because people want to know that you're human, right? Because, again, crises happen to everybody, right? We all break our wrists sometimes. Mm. We all don't do what we're supposed to do. But if you're authentic about it, I think if you are seen to ask for forgiveness or remorseful for how you got here, people want to kind of back somebody that is struggling through these kind of issues.
Now, when it comes to asking for forgiveness or accepting responsibility, how quickly should the head of an organization do that after things go wrong? Because we haven't even got all the facts in,
right.
and you want me to go and accept responsibility. Can you just imagine all the lawsuits that are going to come in if I say I'm sorry?
Well, there's two things there. One, I think the public want to make sure that you're doing it in a timely fashion, that the right person is providing the right commentary. If it is a local issue, then they're going to expect somebody who's locally and known rather than the CEO flying in from Vancouver or New York City. So it has to – the action has to be equal to the act itself. Saying sorry, we didn't hear companies or organizations say sorry or apologize or accept responsibility beforehand because there was a belief that when you said you were sorry or apologized, that equaled guilt and that had impact in the court of law. Over the last 10 years, provinces and states have enacted the I'm sorry law, believe it or not, that allows organizations to say they're sorry. Because that was preventing them from coming out and making any public statements without their lawyers. But that doesn't mean that they're in fact admitting guilt.
So the law says that what?
I can say I'm sorry for this happening, but by that action I'm not admitting guilt. I can take responsibility, but I'm not admitting guilt. Now, in Maple Leaf's case, they accepted all. They said that they were guilty. They killed 22 people. They in fact said they were responsible for it. They said they're sorry. And they in fact settled a class action lawsuit within 3 months. So the behaviors of the organization are what people were watching. Right? The words and the behaviors have to, in fact, be congruent for the public to say, well, that company gets it. And I think that's what they said. It was almost, you know, the classic case in the crisis management literature is the Tylenol study in the 1980s when James Burke, who was the CEO, you know, said, take all the products off this table, you know, off. Well, that was different. Between Maple Leaf Foods, the Tylenol case was
it wasn't
an
their
act.
Fault.
It was an act of criminal activity. Somebody, in fact, had put the cyanide in selected bottles in the Chicago area, but they found that they had no option but to do that because their credibility of their products were in question, and there wasn't certainty about whether or not. Because in fact, when you looked at the Tylenol manufacturing, arsenic is used somewhere in that process, so they couldn't absolutely say it wasn't us. So by that time, and again, we don't have the communicative environment that we have today. As soon as it was confirmed that listeriosis was tied to Maple Leaf products, McCain said, we have no choice. We have to do this. We, in fact, have to take responsibility. It happened here, and we have to open the door. And, you know, when I was doing my study, I was doing interviewing a lot of journalists who were covering it, and I said, you know, the two things that that caught my attention about this company were in their mission and values. Their number one value statement was do the right thing. And the media kind of laughed and they said, well, isn't that kind of a duh moment? You know, shouldn't everybody do the right thing? I said, well, do the right thing for whom? Do the right thing for the shareholders is not taking $80 million of product off the table. Doing the right thing for your employees is not, in fact, shutting down the plant. So doing the right thing for whom really determines on what your values are. And what McCain said, we have to do the right thing for the customer. And taking the right, doing the right thing for the customer is protecting them because we don't know whether our products are safe right now. And so that's a whole bunch of other costs. The second thing of their mission and values said, dare to be transparent. Well, here in the face of the crisis, they opened their doors to anybody that wanted to come in and inspect that, including the media. And that I remember one media writer from the Sun said, yeah, they gave us unbelievable access in a crisis that we've never had before. I said, so, you know, that's communicative behavior. And we watch and judge organizations and people by that. And we make these intuitive decisions that you're trustworthy. And so if you say you're going to do this, I'm going to believe you.
Terry, how does one get into this crazy field?
Well, I kind of fell into it. It had a personal relationship because at a very young age, my family was stricken by crisis. And I think that kind of set the stage for me that whether I knew it or not, that when crisis happened, I my work kind of focused on those kind of areas. And then in my consulting world, I was able to help certain companies manage crisis. One of the biggest crises that I helped an organization manage was the town of Walkerton. When the town of Walkerton called me in May of 2000 to help them respond to the E. coli poison in their water and then to help them recover from that and to sort of get back on their feet. I think what you need is competencies, obviously, in communications, problem solving, the ability to be a convergent thinker. So all these things are happening and you have to kind of make sense of them. And so that ability to look at these multiple options and then decide on, you know, on a course of actions and then to move the organization forward. I think you have to be a strategic thinker. I think you have to be.
So is it a matter of looking at, okay, here are the possibilities. And if we do this or if this happens, here are the possibilities there. So is that a lot of linear thinking about, okay, if we do this, this might?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of process engineering that you look at in terms of potential scenarios or outcomes. You do that when you have the ability to prepare. When you work with organizations to help them prepare for the eventuality, it's just like a sports team. And so I coached hockey and to help 10-year-olds to understand action has equal reaction and what do you do and how do you anticipate so that you have a playbook. But you know, when game time comes, the other team all of a sudden interacts with you, and you have to respond to that as well. So, sure, we want to think about systematizing the preparation of crisis management so that, in fact, when it does happen, organizations are able to enact. Sometimes you're not on it. So Walkerton, I had no relationship with the town of Walkerton until May of 2000 when they called and said, can you help?
So they called you in, they must have been in a complete panic. And everyone expecting you to make things happen just like that. What's the first two or three things when you walk into a situation like that?
So, well, I'll give you a perfect example on the Walkerton. So I got a call before it really went public the night before, and they said, we've got this. You know, there's this big meeting that's going to happen the next day. Come up to Walkerton and help us manage it. And when I drove to Walkerton from Kitchener, so it was an hour and a half, I started to listen to CBC radio and the news started to getting out that this was a very serious. People were sick. There was a death associated with it. So I'm automatically thinking that this is a worst case scenario. And so as I pulled into the town hall, there was already 15 news reporters there. And so the scale of this now is at a magnitude of order that means this is going to take a lot of just time and effort to kind of get through the immediacy of the crisis. And again, we have different kinds of stages, you know. The Walkerton event, there was a pre-crisis, but nobody knew about it. Right? It was happening because they had a 100-year flood and they had systems that were out of service. Things were happening. The fact that when they announced that people had died, that was the crisis. And then there's a post-crisis. Well, here we are. And my job – and when I walked into this room of – Ministry of the Environment, all these big wigs, And they said, what did we do? I said, we've got to open the door. We have to be transparent. We have to have some level of communications. I don't know what that is yet because I don't know what is going on. So we're going to have to spend some time understanding what's going on. And then we're just going to have to tell people what we're doing right now in response. We can't look back because there will be investigations, and we can't look forward yet because we don't know what the future holds for us. We can only say what we're doing right now. And sometimes it's going to be pretty and sometimes it's not going to be pretty. You know, we had a national news conference covered on all Canadian stations and, in fact, on CNN. You couldn't script it because I didn't know what was going to happen. And I remember there was about 50 news reporters there, and there was a citizen that had gotten in. And he'd put up his hand, and I thought, I'm going to recognize him against probably all the best conventional wisdom because you're losing control at that point. Because my view is that that person, amongst anybody else in this room, has more of a right to ask that question of the mayor of the town than the news reporters who have never been to Waconon before. And it created a bit of a hellstorm because he asked very pointed questions of the leadership, which had to be asked. So my view was we might as well get them asked now to set the stage of expectation.
How does an organization that they're in business – They seem to have things under control and the marketplace likes them, they're respected. How does an organization prepare for a worst case scenario and hope it never comes? But how do they repair and how do they decide how much time and money should they invest?
That's a great question because that's the thing that most organizations, in fact, struggle with. A, who should lead it? What should be the scope of this kind of activity, and how much resources are we willing to put into play? And yet they do it every day with their insurance broker. Right? Their insurance broker has assigned a value of the risk associated to the organization, and that's the monthly premium that they have to in fact. So we think, let's look at the monthly premium. What is that monthly premium for your insurance to cover all your issues? And let's look at that as an initial investment opportunity because that's where we're going to start. Because my view is that if you do the crisis preparation and management well, you can actually reduce your insurance risk because you're showing to the insurer that you're prepared. Most organizations aren't prepared. So it's usually a C-suite responsibility. So somebody in the leadership has to say, I'm going to take it on. We need to kind of scope it out by identifying what resources internally we have, what resources we have to go out and have. And then we start to look at what are the most likely scenarios that could happen to the organization. You know, a satellite falling out of the sky in our building and putting us out of business is probably not going to happen. But if you're in the transportation business, something with your fleet is something that's likely going to happen. I used an example in a recent presentation about a CEO who had a family history of heart disease and sudden death. And so one of the scenarios that we talked about, what's this level of transition, succession planning within the organization? Because that could happen. In fact, it did happen to that organization. So I think what you do is you put together a tiered response. What's the basics? The basic is we should have a plan, and we should have a plan that identifies who we contact in the event of having a crisis. It shouldn't be all cloud-based because we know last week, I think, McMaster had 2 days without any internet, so things happen. So you have to have a multidimensional plan that allows you to, in fact, communicate to your stakeholders in a very timely fashion. So a plan, a spokesperson, some initial kind of communication activities, and some training for those people that are, in fact, going to be thrust into the public domain. And then you can start to look and say, okay, should we do some scenarios? Should we do tabletop exercise? Should we do full-blown scenarios? Who do we engage? Who do we have the conversation that talks about our risk management, crisis management, communications? So, you know, you can have a fairly simple, fairly contained crisis strategy, and then depending on the organization, you can have a pretty full-blown one.
A small entrepreneur, what should they do? What 3 or 4 things should every one of them probably do to prepare themselves for some sort of crisis?
Yeah. Well, I think the number one is if you're small, like I did 20 years ago, you have to have the necessary financial and insurance instruments available to you in the event that something happens. Disability insurance for a solo practitioner was critical. If I wasn't able to make go out and consult, there's no income coming in. Now, the trade-off and what most entrepreneurs would say, that's a very expensive product. It is a very expensive product. I mean, I couldn't believe it when my insurance agent said, but I had to understand that there was a higher risk of me not being able to pay my financial obligations for my wife and I and two children to be able to survive. So we could have lost the house. So that's a business cost that's important. I think you have to think about also if, as you grow the business, succession planning. You know, who's going to be there to be able to take over from you? When I was looking to transition out of my consulting practice into do a PhD, I was responsible for 80% of my billings. I had to get other people up to speed so that they, in fact, could be take over for that. You know? So whether it's working with the clients that I did. And what I did is I took my staff, we did a retreat, and we were planning a traditional kind of strategic planning retreat. They walked into the boardroom, and there was an envelope on the door, and it was a scenario about me being in the hospital, not being able to practice for the next year. How were they going to, in fact, take the business to that next level? So those kind of things, always thinking about it and taking the necessary business moves to be able to do it. Sometimes it's about growing the business. Sometimes it's about selling the business.
If someone were experiencing a crisis, let's not call it a worst case crisis, but a crisis notable in their business at this moment, and they weren't able to call Terry Flynn to ask for advice, what two or three things would you tell them that they should do right now?
Take a breath, first of all. Start to look at the resources you have to, in fact, manage your way through this. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. Be open and honest. And hopefully you've developed great relationships with your stakeholders, whether it's your employees or customers, so that you're able to continue. The challenge is that when an organization has a crisis, that normal will not come back again. You'll always go to a new normal. And that's what they think, you know, we'll get through this, we'll go back to it. It won't happen. You have to find out what that new normal, a new operating mechanism or modality is.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.